Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 50, Here Comes the Heat.
This Week in Law is brought to you by GoToMyPC. Think remote access to your PC is complicated? Think again. It's easy with GoToMyPC. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMyPC.com/TWiL. And by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiL. And by the new Carbonite Pro. It's simple, secure, and affordable online backup for your small business. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com.
Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, your host. This is our 50th episode of TWiL. I'm very excited about that and very excited to have with us most, if eventually all, of our regular panel. And also a special guest, Ed Adams, CEO of Fastcase. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Denise.
You're welcome.
Congratulations on 50 episodes. That's a real milestone.
Yeah, thanks so much. I hope this isn't the only 50th anniversary that I make in my life, but so far it's the first. So we'll see how that goes. Ed's company makes a mobile application for the iPhone that deals with legal research. So we're going to chat with him about that in a minute. Also with us is Ernie Svensson. Ernie, great to have you back.
It's great to be here as always. I look forward to chatting with everybody and to talking with Ed because he's got a great product that I use all the time.
Oh, that's good to know. Okay, and also with us right now is Colette Vogel. Hi, Colette. Thanks for coming back.
Hi, good to be back. Happy 50.
Thank you,
Denise. That's a big deal.
Happy 50 to all of us. And Colette, of course, is our in-house person with Microsoft, as well as a member of, what is it? What do they call it? The external fellowship program at the Center for...
It's the non-resident fellowship program.
Non-resident, yes.
With the Stanford Center for Internet and Society. Yeah, so, my thoughts here, I'm wearing my Stanford hat. Of course, if things come up about Microsoft, I'm not speaking on their behalf necessarily. So,
wonderful. Thanks so much. And Ed, I'm so sorry. I think I mistakenly called you Ed Adams, who is with the ABA Journals. You are Ed Walters.
But Ed is a very esteemed publisher and a good friend.
He is. He's actually been, I can't remember if he's been on TWiL. I know he's been on one of my podcasts at one point or another, but yes, he's a great guy. Where can folks find you on Twitter, Ed? Because I know that you frequently have good insights and information for folks there.
Yeah, it's EJ Walters.
EJ Walters on Twitter. Handle. Great. So I wanted to take a minute. We have featured Fastcase as a resource of the week here on TWiL before, and I wanted to get you on just real quickly to talk kind of from a big picture standpoint about the future of legal research. Fastcase, I think, is pretty interesting and exciting because it's on a mobile platform right now just for the iPhone, but I understand you're working on other apps.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's also scot-free, which is a really interesting thing in the world of legal research, which traditionally has been really, really, really expensive and difficult for lay people or perhaps even just smaller players in the legal professional field to access with any kind of regularity and frequency. So tell us about free and why that is a good choice for you guys.
It's the most powerful price in the world. And you wouldn't believe the response we've had to it. It's great to do if you can pull it off. We actually have worked very closely with state bar associations who offer Fastcase for free as well on the desktop. And it's been so popular. They actually pay us for the benefit and then make it available for free to their members. I know Ernie gets it through the Louisiana State Bar Association, but there's 17 state bar associations that offer it. and about 380,000 lawyers who get the desktop app for free. So when we came out with the iPhone app, you know, we looked at it and said, what should the price for this thing be? Do you charge like $2 or $10? You know, I know there's some other legal apps on there that charge as much as like $50. But it was pretty clear to us, the right price for it is free. I mean, when we started Fastcase, the idea was very simple. Make research smarter and democratize the law. You know, make more law available to more people at lower prices. And so free is a great price to do that. And the response has been truly overwhelming. It's crazy.
Well, a lot of law is free these days, right? Coming out of legislatures and courthouses. Are you leveraging that? Are you leveraging Google Scholar Legal? How is it that you are making what traditionally has been so expensive available at the most popular price ever?
Well, so it's two things. One, it's kind of a rule of 80-20, and another is just kind of being smarter about the process. If you look at the way people do legal research, about 80% of their time is spent just searching cases and codes. And, you know, traditionally, the only way you've been able to buy that is with bundled in editorial resources from the kind of established traditional players. Editorial resources like headnotes and treatises and things like that. It turns out that that last 20% of the effort incurs 80% of the expense. So we said, look, you know, there's a great market for that. If what you really want is headnotes, there's good places you can buy that. But if you want to buy the just cases themselves unbundled from the editorial resources, seems like you could do like 80% of the work at 20% of the cost. So that's the idea behind Fastcase. We just take the cases straight from the courts. You know, the courts write their own headnotes sometimes, but we don't write them. We don't have a, you know, cubicle farm full of otherwise unemployable lawyers writing headnotes or key numbers. We take these things straight from the courts and straight from the legislatures. And if you do that, you can really focus on building smarter technology that helps find answers better. And so that rule of 80-20 allows us to offer legal research at much lower costs, and in a lot of cases for free. So it's a very disruptive business model right now, in the sense that there are literally hundreds of thousands of lawyers who are moving away from bundled legal research, where you have to buy stuff that you don't need, to unbundled legal research. You buy only what you need when you need it.
So in your model where everything is free, how does the purchase issue even come up?
Well, you know, we make it as free as we can. I'd love to say that everything is free on Fastcase, but it's not. Mm. So we do have retail subscribers who subscribe to the service. Some of the biggest law firms in the country subscribe to it. So Cadwallader, Simpson Thatcher, some of the really largest law firms in the country subscribe to Fastcase for their firms and globally. So everyone in the firm gets access to it. We also sell individual subscriptions. So people go to Fastcase.com, they sign up for like a $95 a month subscription. But by far the most popular price that we offer is free. When state bar associations pay us to make it available to their members, it's kind of like everybody wins, because lawyers get access for free. The state bar association gets credit for doing something great for their members. And we get paid enough to provide a really great service and keep innovating with cool technology.
Ernie, how are you using this?
Well, you know, I'm a solo practitioner, so when I went out on my own, you know, I looked at everything that I might spend money on, and I was willing to spend money in some areas that I didn't previously spend money on, like computers and technology, but I didn't want to spend money on things that I didn't use a lot. And the cost of getting a Westlaw subscription, you know, given the amount of time I was really going to be doing research, it didn't make sense for me. I mean, I figured I lived close to a law library. I could go look it up, you know, and that's how I'd kind of get by. But then the Bar Association offered Fastcase to its members for free. And so I was obviously very motivated to play with it and check it out. And when it first started, it had fewer features than it has now, but it, you know, it basically got the job done. I mean, you know, basically I wanted to know, okay, what is that case that somebody cited in a brief say? Does it really say what they said it says? Let me look it up. That was a great way of finding cases. And then just, you know, you could do the basic research. I mean, you know, I clerked for a federal judge for 2 years, and we had all the bells and whistles we would want. And I got really good at doing research, and I got really good at figuring out that most of the time lawyers misrepresented what they said the law was. And, you know, you have to kind of weed through. But I also, you know, came to the conclusion that really you kind of instinctively know what the law is. You know, it's not, you know, like the law isn't, at least to a lawyer who's practiced it, you know, it usually doesn't surprise you. You know, I mean, we talk about the stuff that's surprising on the show a lot, but most of the law is pretty mundane. It's in the pocket. We know what it is. And if it doesn't, if it strikes you as not making sense, it probably is because either it's an anomaly or the other side misrepresented it. So it's not like I need to really drill into all the minutiae that Westlaw would provide me. So it was that 80-20 thing that Ed just talked about. I mean, it's like I'd be paying 80% more for something that I was using, you know, in my case, probably less than 20% of the time, more like 5%. And if I really need that, I can go to the library and I can use the books and they have the digest. And that's really how I learned to research anyway. And if I'm going to do that kind of research, you know, I'd rather use the books and it's free. So I'm all about free.
It's a good price.
Yes. Ernie, do you find that it gives you everything that you need as far as the shepherdizing or citing references, that kind of thing? And for our listeners who have no idea what I'm talking about, part of one of the most important parts of legal research is being able to tell a court what has happened with the decision once it was issued. Have other courts followed it? Have they decided that it was completely full of hot air and it doesn't deserve any consideration? And so a lot of the very expensively priced legal research services will give you that kind of information. And I'm wondering how that fares on Fastcase.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I graduated from law school in 85. And at that time, you know, we were taught how to use Shepherds, and Shepherds were these books and we knew how to use them. And ours was the first class that had computerized legal research, you know, that we were taught computerized legal research. And it was Lexis back in those days. But, you know, quickly I started to ask myself, and I say quickly, over a period of years, like, why am I doing this Shepherds thing when I can type the citation in to Lexis and it'll show me every case that's, I mean, essentially I can do my own Shepherds. And, you know, over time, Shepherds diminished in value and it's still, there's still some value to all this, but I think that you need to kind of just ask yourself, what are you looking for? For some things, the printed documents are great. Like I love the digest, the actual physical books. I like them because I can browse them very quickly in a way that I can't do on a computer. And so I'm fortunate that I work close to the U.S. Fifth Circuit Library, which is one of the best libraries, you know, in the state. And I can walk right next door and go through the digest. And it's great. If I want to quickly survey an area of the law, that's the way to do it. But if I'm not doing that and I'm just trying to find out, is there a case on point or has this case been affected by some subsequent case? I don't need Shepherds to do that. I just type in the case name or the citation and see what subsequent cases cited. And yeah, I have to go through it manually. That's true. I have to go through it manually. But again, in most cases, it's not so overwhelming. It's like if I'm looking for every case that cites the Fourth Amendment, well, yeah, okay, then I'm in trouble. But if I'm just looking for a case that cited some other case that's kind of in a, you know, mundane area of law, there's not going to be 1,000 cases. I live in Louisiana, too. That makes it easier. There's going to be 24, you know, and three of those are going to be recent and seemingly on point.
And Denise, Fastcase has a feature called Authority Check that shows you all the later citing cases. We actually do some cool stuff that even Shepherds doesn't do. We have a kind of an interactive three-dimensional timeline view that shows you how all of the later cases fall on a graph, a pictorial representation of it that gives a lot of information that even the old kind of Shepherds doesn't. We put links in there to Shepherds and Keysights too. I mean, I think Shepherds and Keysight are nice services. And so because we're nice guys, we actually put links in there to both of those services as well.
That is nice.
I hate it when I say this, but I have lawyers all the time who say, look, I can't cancel my Lexis because I need Shepherds, so I have to pay $5,000 a year for Lexis. And I say, hey, you know, that's fine if that works for you. But by the way, you can shepherdize cases for $6 a pop. So we have tons of, you know, people who use Fastcase, they use Authority Check as a first pass. And then before they file a brief, you know, they'll pay like $4.25 per Keysight or $6 per Shepherds with the links we provide. So it's kind of nice. We play nicely with others in that respect.
Love it when people play nicely with others. Ed, why build an iPhone app for legal research? At this point, we're all pretty used to doing it on the computer, I think. Why make it mobile?
Well, I really feel like we're in a period right now. I think about like 3 or 4 years ago, where there was really this tipping point away from the desktop and towards the laptop. If you think about it, back then, a lot of people had these kind of locked-in-place desktop apps. But nowadays, everybody has a laptop, right? You got to be able to take it with you, put it in your bag at night, take it on the road with you. And I feel like we're in exactly that kind of watershed moment right now for mobile. You know, I find myself going to conferences all the time. I'll pack my computer, and then I'll never open it up because the entire time I'm checking email or doing applications on my mobile device. And so it feels like exactly that kind of watershed moment. We're not all the way there yet, but it's very clear that the future for research and for legal technology is going to be mobile. Will it be 100% mobile? No way. We'll still use desktop apps. We'll still use laptops. We'll still have those kinds of office connections. But I do think a greater share of what people do with legal technology is going to be mobile and is going to be on the mobile devices. So iPhone was a natural extension for us. It was a great way to kind of play into that mobile future. And as of right now, we kind of own the landscape. I kind of want Fastcase to be the 800-pound gorilla of mobile legal research. There's a couple of other apps in there, but they're not fully formed legal research apps. So you can download like individual state statutes or some building codes, or I know there are some subscription services that if you have a big paid subscription for it, then you can use the mobile app to, you know, leverage your paid subscription. But for Fastcase to be like the only fully formed legal research service out there and to have it be free, I think we just need to be very, very popular. We thought it was going to be popular, but we had no idea just how popular. So when we first launched it, we had a little bit of interest, and then Apple featured it on the homepage of the App Store, and then it was like a rocket ship. It was completely out of control. We had so many people download the app that at some point we were downloaded more and more popular than Bing in the iTunes store, right behind Wikipedia and the Bible.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty overwhelming success. And if you wanted a little bit of a market validation for the future of research being mobile, I think that's your data point.
So what are you doing with the information that you're gathering from people as they register for the app?
Nothing. We just keep it in case they have problems with their registration or with the app later on. If they have errors, we can contact them. But there's really nothing we have to do. We actually have a lot of people who are using the mobile app and who are then going to fastcase.com and subscribing. But we're not pushing it. We're not spamming people or, you know, calling people or anything like that. The thing kind of sells itself.
Do you have that set forth in a privacy policy anywhere?
We don't. But again, I think I don't want to write a privacy policy that would keep us from contacting somebody if they had an error or a problem with the service. And I could imagine times where we might want to email people if, for example, we had like a trouble with the service or a new release. So I want to make sure that we have the ability to get in touch with our subscribers. But we're really not using that for promotional purposes. We kind of don't need to.
That's good.
Incidentally, the LSBA, the Louisiana State Bar Association, recently did a survey of solo and small firms about the technology that they use. And I think the results are going to be released officially soon, but I was given a copy because I'm on the tech committee. And I find it interesting that of the 61 or so respondents, 39 of them were using Westlaw when asked which online legal research do they use. LexisNexis, not so much, 6. Fastcase, 36. So almost as many people are using Fastcase in solo and small firms in Louisiana as are using Westlaw.
Hooray!
Well, I think you're looking right. You're looking right at the bleeding edge when you look at those numbers. Because I think, you know, solo and small firms are always testing the waters for the new and more unconventionally priced tools. Well, so that's pretty cool.
That's where the biggest part of the problem was too. If you look at who had access when we started 10 years ago, large firms did okay. You know, they had pretty good access to legal research, but small firms, solo practitioners, 5 and fewer, either had really piecemeal access or just terrible access. And that's where everyone is. If you look at, you know, just kind of demographically, it's something like 78-79% of lawyers in the country are in firms 5 or fewer. So, you know, there was a huge underserved part of the market, and that's where most of the lawyers are. So, it, you know, our hope is we can really kind of hit that sweet spot with a service that does right by small firms and solo practitioners, but has tools that are so powerful that even the firm's biggest law firms make good use out of it.
Have you done your iPad application yet?
We're looking at it just today. I just read something that said that the iPad is going to be available for pre-order on March 12th and that it's going to ship on April 3rd. So
that's what I read.
We've got our sleeves rolled up. We're really excited about the iPad. I think it's a great illustration of what I was talking about. Is every lawyer going to have an iPad? No way. But is the future going to look a lot like iPad? Yeah, you betcha. And so if we are the kind of 800-pound gorilla of mobile legal research, turning the tables a little bit on the traditional players, awesome. I love that idea.
Me too.
So when you get strange, unidentified calls to your house and you star 69 back, is it someone at Westlaw or Lexis?
Yeah, I'm surprised they haven't put a hit on it yet. It's got to be costing them hundreds of millions of dollars of business.
Yeah.
Can I jump in and ask a quick question about the ethos of the what you were saying earlier, Ed, is sort of making these things available, the cases and statutes and things that are really part of what we as citizens should have access to. How do you see what you're doing fits with things like Carl Malamud's efforts with publicresource.org and other places online that seem to be, they don't seem to be targeted at professionals, but I use them occasionally for finding cases and statutes. And I think of like the Cornell Law Library's website that has almost every USC, United States Code section in there, usually very up to date. So I'm curious where your offerings fit in that ecosystem.
Well, I think hand in glove. I mean, you know, we were actually the first partner with Public Resource to make available the complete collection of the United States Supreme Court opinions and all of the circuit opinions back to, I think, one of second one. So we worked with Public Resource, and we were the only ones who did, to make that collection available. And again, you know, if you kind of hold us against the metric of making every last dollar in the world, we're not, you know, the hugest success story. If you measure us against the metric of making the law more democratic, more available to people, and make technology that makes it easier to find stuff faster and just downright cool, then we're a huge success. You know. And so working together with Carl Malamud and Tom Bruce at Cornell's Legal Information Institute to further democratize the law, perfect. And you know, just to put this in context, I think in the past, if you look at what constituted legal research, the biggest challenge was just access, just in some sense, having all the cases and having all the statutes. But those days are long gone. And in some sense, you know, they kind of always were. If you want just kind of free access to cases or whatever, you could very simply just, like Ernie said, you know, go to your local law library, you know, go to a county law library or the Fifth Circuit library. You can get access to everything for free. These days, it's not really about just access. It's not just about, you know, in some sense, having the collection. It's really about smarter software that helps you find stuff better. And so, you know, we recognized this a long time ago, starting in like 2003. We did things like sorting the most relevant cases to the top, which you just now start to see in Westlaw Next. We've been doing that for, you know, 7 years or more, giving people the ability to resort the search results to bring the best stuff to the top. We even do this nerdy, we call it cool, but I recognize very nerdy, integrated citation analysis. So when you get search results on FastCase, you can see how many times each case has been cited in the world, and then how many times it's been cited just by your other search results. So if what you get back are a bunch of Section 508 compliance cases, and there's 300 of them, you can see how many times they cite each other. And so it's using technology like this, and like these kind of visualization tools, the interactive timeline view, that help you find answers much, much faster, that are going to be the things that add the value in the future. I'm not trying to say the editorial stuff doesn't have value. Of course it does. But what I'm saying is that we're kind of in an intermediate phase, beyond mere access, but at a point where we can add a lot of value in technology too.
It sounds a lot like cloud, the cloud services model of having the cloud become smarter and smarter, you know, so you're doing things that are making the cloud smarter or your service smarter through the cloud. So to what extent is the information, like the search terms that people put into the system or what they end up downloading? I don't know. I haven't used it, so I don't know if you can download the cases or whatever. But like, does that information that the crowd is doing, actions that the users are taking, help inform what your service provides and improve it? I mean, this is classic kind of what Google, I understand, does with search queries and documents and things.
Right. We don't do it today, but we absolutely will have that in a new version of FastCase. It's called FastCase 7, and we're going to be launching it, I hope, sometime this year. It won't take us quite the 5 years that it took Westlaw to put out Westlaw Next, but we've been working on a lot of these tools right now that just help bring better results to the top. And user experience has got to be a part of that. We were born in the cloud in some sense, so we always were a web app. It wasn't ever downloadable software. And we tend to price it more like a service. So you can subscribe to FastCase for as little as 1 month at a time. You don't have to do like kind of a three-year contract. And these things were pretty cutting edge when we started doing them in like, you know, 2002, 2003. But today, I think it's basically everyone's expectation, right? I mean, that's the way people consume these things. So that's the way they ought to be able to use them.
Cool.
Hey, Ed, I wondered how, before we let you go, two things. Number one, I just wanted to make a comment that dovetails with what Colette was saying, that now it's not so much about being able to get to the resources because they're out there, but it's more about aggregation and curation. And the more that we have smart tools that come along and help with that, the better. Secondly, I was just wondering, as the tools get smarter and start leveraging the free resources that are out there and just need to be sort of better organized and surfaced, how do we deal with the issue that the courts are still promulgating rules that require us to work within the old infrastructure and specifically within old models of pagination? You know, this bit of phraseology appears on this page in this book published by this publisher. How do you grapple with that?
Wow. It's a whole can of worms. I'll not get on my soapbox too much about this, but it's a topic near and dear to my heart. So there's been a move in several states towards media neutral citation. That just means that when you cite a case, you don't have to cite it to a specific book that it appears in. You basically cite it by reference to the court, what order it was decided in. I know Ernie, Louisiana is actually a pioneer in media neutral citation. And I think that's the future. I think part of the problem is that if you cited a case to a court and didn't use the kind of official or the commercial reporter citation, they wouldn't know where to find it. So, you know, at some point in the future, when we get a head up of steam here at FastCase, we're basically going to have to just go and retrofit every case ever decided with a media neutral citation and then build this, you know, with apologies to Doug Adams, this Babelfish application. You basically go to a website and say, here's a media neutral citation, and it will spit out all of the, you know, official citations for it, the reporter citations that exist. Or if you put in a reporter citation, if you cite, you know, a Virginia reporter, you'll get back the media neutral citation, the Southeast reporter citation. And so the idea is that these things become commoditized, and really the citation to it isn't something unique. So if you have the Virginia reporter and not the Southeastern reporter, you know, you can plug one citation in and translate it to the other. If you get a media neutral citation, you can translate it to any one of those. It seems a little crazy to me. It's so weirdly anachronistic that you're trying to, you know, cite things to a page in a book, which you may or may not have. When the thing starts in kind of digital format, you end up consuming it in digital format. But at some point in the process, you go through this weird phase where it ends up in paper and you know, turn the page and find that point of law. Wrong for so many reasons. The books are slow to come out. When you cite to a particular page, you're left guessing what part of that page you're talking about. I really think media neutral citation is the answer, where you can say, I'm citing this specific paragraph, so nobody's wondering. It has a citation the minute it's issued. So it's born with its own citation that self-authenticates. No one's waiting for the books. No one's worried about which copy of it they have or which reporter they have to subscribe to. I think that's the place we need to end up. You can see some activity in the American Association of Law Libraries working on this. We've done a lot of work with them on that. I know that the law.gov movement is very concerned with media neutral citation. I know that individual law librarians are really concerned about it. It's going to have to be the administrative office of the U.S. courts, I think, that takes the next step, as well as individual states. So Oklahoma, Wisconsin, there's a lot of states that do this pretty well. And then I think it's going to be incumbent on individual publishers, maybe the publishers who don't have a lot to lose with the proprietary citation formats. So maybe it'll be somebody like us who says, look, you know, we're just going to go ahead and retrofit these things with media neutral citations, issue them as they come out, and then make them open. You know, if anybody wants to use these media neutral citations, they can. The important thing is that there's one universal standard for it that everyone can use. But you're right. I mean, this kind of old way of doing it in the books, crazy. There's no way that's going to last. My son's going to look back to this time and say, wait a minute, you did what? Why were you citing these things to books? That's crazy.
Yeah, it is weird how we go and sort of move the process back 20 or 30 years in time every time we file a brief with the courts and have to include citations to paper books. So right. Thanks so much for your thoughts on that and for working on all of this for us and for the folks who are interested in having law on the go. Check out the fastcase.com legal research application on the iPhone and coming to other platforms.
Thanks so much for joining. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. So, hey guys, we've got some various news stories to go through. Evan Brown's going to join us. He's been on a conference call, but should be available now if we can get him on the call somewhere along the way here as we continue to talk. Some stuff in the news this week from other things we've been following. The Real DVD case looks like it is finally gone, and that Real Networks is going to kill Real DVD, the product at the heart of that case. Did you guys see this, and do you have any thoughts on the death of Real DVD or what this lawsuit means, Colette?
It's sort of sad. It's also sad, I think of also the VO case where VO won their lawsuit. It was a DMCA thing, somewhat different part of the DMCA. They won and they went out of business. So it's really interesting. I read the article, the CNET article and the links. I feel very much aligned with Fred Von Lohman's quote that the message this sends is if you get into the business of enabling consumers to do with DVDs what they've long been able to do with CDs, you'll get sued out of business. That's sort of the highlight quote. And it's true. I think there are things you could argue about on the opinion. I'm a little disappointed it's not going to go through the appeal process, only because I think some of the opinion could have been tailored or characterized differently and better for some innovation issues by the Ninth Circuit. But I think that what I understand is that they've settled and they're just not going to push the case anymore.
Yep. RIP Real DVD. Ernie, any parting thoughts?
This case has been going on for a while. And meanwhile, I'm perfectly able to use other software to make copies of DVDs. And at one point, I was busily taking all the DVDs in my house and ripping them all to my computer hard drive so that I could serve them up whenever I wanted to. And over time, I realized this is a huge waste of storage and a waste of time, because I don't really want to watch a movie more than once or twice if I want to watch it twice at all. And if I do, all of these movies are either currently available on iTunes for rent or the cable box for rent, or eventually they'll all be available for rent. I don't really want to own DVDs. So, I know other people do, but the time will pass and then it will just be on demand. I want this video file and you pay for it and you rent it. So down the road, I don't think that this is really going to be a big deal. It's really not a big deal now because you can still, rip DVDs if you really want to. I'm not going to tell you how.
Yes, thank you so much. Or we might be sued for inducing infringement. When I was reading through this, I had the same sensation as I did in our discussion with Ed a moment ago, that actually the DVD technology, although, you know, I think it will linger around for a while, is something that's not the wave of the future and probably not going to be with us for too much longer. And, you know, maybe our children will look back on the way we do things now and go, remember when we had those little discs, and think that they're quite a novelty. I don't know how relevant this case is, but it is an example of the MPAA deciding that if they have the ability to stop a copying technology that users want to have access to, even if there are perfectly legal reasons for making the copy, that's just going to go by the wayside. Other interesting thing that happened this week in cases we've been following for a while is the Viacom versus Google YouTube case. Speaking of the future of movie watching, YouTube certainly stands poised at that precipice, I think, more than any kind of DVD watching technology. Although, I don't know, maybe with movies like Avatar and differences in a richer user experience, maybe we're not at the point really of being able to talk about distributing those kinds of works online. But Google, they're at that brink of the future, is subject to this huge $1 billion lawsuit filed 3 years ago, where they've been mired down in the discovery process for all that time. It looks like the discovery process is coming to the end. Colette, you want to bring us up to speed on what happens next?
Yeah, well, so I read the link, of course, in the notes, but I understand that today is the day the cross motions for summary judgment will be filed. I'm actively kind of keeping an eye on Pacer and Twitter and wherever else I might learn first of the filing. The thing is that it's possible, because there's a lot of confidential information likely to be argued about in the motions, that they will not actually be publicly available for a few more days. The parties typically will also lodge a redacted copy of the whatever supporting documents that might contain confidential information, or even parts of the briefs may be confidential. So to the extent that that's the case, we, the public, might not actually get to see these documents, even the redacted versions, I should say, for a few more days. It's just hard to tell, you know, how that will actually all play out. But, you know, by next Friday's show, there should be a lot to talk about to see what the arguments are on the summary judgment motions. And for people who aren't clear on the procedure, so they've spent a couple years now sharing documents formally through the discovery process and fighting about certain things that they can probably have access to and whatever. And in theory, all of the things they're looking for should support or give information about the merits of their case, and then each party can submit briefing asking the court to make a determination without a trial, because the facts are undisputed, and the court can then decide certain issues before trial, or maybe in lieu of trial, depending on the situation. So I'm sure, I don't know what the briefing, like the schedule is, like when the opposition briefs are due, when the reply briefs would be due, and when the hearing is, but I would imagine that will all happen in the next 2 months to 3 months. And then we might have to wait for a ruling beyond that. But it's a really important time. I'm sure the lawyers on the cases have been up and day and night for the last few weeks, pulling their briefs together and declarations and all the supporting evidence that they need to submit.
Right, and we should just mention for folks' benefit that the reason there will be, we think, so much confidential information in these summary judgment papers is because Google's business methods, or and the measures they have taken to prevent infringement on YouTube are going to be at the heart of the legal arguments here. And so there may be things in there that are subject to protective order as far as they're sharing competitive information with other video sites, I suppose. Which raises an interesting question. Why do you guys think that Viacom went after Google and YouTube of all targets? Are they simply the 800-pound gorilla? I mean, MySpace is certainly huge and rife with infringing material. Any thoughts on why Google gets to be the poster child for infringement here, Ernie?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when Google acquired YouTube, it wasn't clear how Google was going to make money, and YouTube was pretty much operating in the Wild West, and Google paid a lot of money for it. And I think that was kind of the shock value that got a lot of attention. And I don't remember how quickly after Google acquired, but it was within a year, right, that this lawsuit was filed, or maybe even less.
Yeah.
So I think that was a lot of it.
Well, I also think it's media companies and relationships that mm-hmm. might have also driven that. I think, if I'm correct, MySpace is owned by Rupert Murdoch and News Corp. Is that right?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, I bet they are more friendly with Viacom even a few years ago over these kinds of things from a relationship standpoint than any of these companies, these major content companies are. You know, and the kinds of relationships they might have had with a startup like YouTube or with Google, who is no longer a startup by all means, but, you know, certainly has a very different view of how media can be used by internet tool kind of companies, if you want to, you know, search companies and whatnot. So I bet a lot of it is relationships and you know, you want to pick your defendants carefully. to put it nicely, but you know, I fully expect a settlement. I can't imagine this case actually getting a ruling, but maybe I'll be wrong. It'd be really great because we always get settlements, and you know, I think it'd be great for copyright law to get more rulings on important issues so that we know or we have more data points on counseling clients and on thinking about policy and changes that we might want Congress to make if we had a few more rulings along the way. But I think when Viacom first sued, they were probably thinking this is something we need to do in order to negotiate a better deal and rate with Google and, or, you know, YouTube and Google for whatever the deal is that they want to try and strike at some point. So it could just be a negotiation tactic, although it's a very expensive one if you think about it. And the way the web has developed and the use of aggregation tools and all sorts of other stuff. I mean, Google is in a much different place today than it was 2.5 years ago, I think. And also in the public eye, they're a little more scrutinized now. And so I think that, you know, how a jury might perceive this case might be different today than it was 2.5 years ago. I forget. This is in New York. Yeah. So it's not here in Silicon Valley, which I think is the juries here are a little more sympathetic to, you know, accepting revolutionary and disruptive technologies than maybe the New York jury pool, although I'm really not sure about that fully.
Yeah, well, the decisions have certainly shook out that way. If you look at the Ninth Circuit, which has had its share of, you know, Napster-like decisions, but the Second Circuit tends to be pretty harsh on companies who are breaking new ground and getting sued for it.
Yeah. Speaking of content companies, I don't, you know, change the topic back if you'd like, but I just saw today or maybe yesterday, I think I read it this morning though, that Perfect 10 is refiled its motion for preliminary injunction against Google in that case about the thumbnails. And they came up with a bunch of reasons why all these new facts came to light since the time of their original preliminary injunction motion several years ago now.
Wow.
So it's interesting, and I wonder what all played into that decision, because it's pretty unusual to lose a preliminary injunction motion and then file again later. I mean, something really has to change to have any real strength to that motion. So
this is the one where Google won a really decisive victory.
Yeah,
and at the Ninth Circuit in the court. Yeah, fair use and not creating or not interfering with the original market for the works and all kinds of stuff.
I mean, we talked
on the show before too that the mobile industry has certainly changed in that intervening time. And perhaps that plays into their wanting to have a second bite at the apple and trying to shut down the images.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of tactics, you know, that parties and lawyers can use. So it did strike me as surprising. And maybe, you know, when some of us have had a chance to look at the briefs, we can talk a little more knowledgeably about the arguments. But it did surprise me to see a second preliminary injunction motion filed. And I think they have, the article I saw just mentioned, you know, like the volume of copying that they've now found and repurposing of the copying. And then they referenced some, you know, decisions in Europe. And that kind of surprised me because of, I'm like, well, why would a court here care? I mean, that's like, yeah, it's interesting. It's anecdotal, but it's not going to affect the likelihood of success here, I would say. But I don't know.
Well, we've got a lot more stories to discuss, and we have our tip of the week and resource of the week coming up after the break in a bit. But right now, I want to thank one of our sponsors, and it's a new sponsor to Twill, Carbonite Pro. This is a service that was developed for individuals, but if you're part of a small business, more than 100,000 of you have used this service to back up computers in your offices. And now Carbonite is introducing their backup service in a new package that's optimized and priced for small businesses, and it's called Carbonite Pro. We were talking before about the importance of the cloud in more and more business practices. I don't know why you wouldn't be backing up your business data to the cloud, given that opportunity and given the fact that with a service like Carbonite Pro, you can do it for less than $10 a month or as low as $10 a month and going up from there. It's easy to use. You don't need any extra hardware. You don't need to be technical to set it up. It gives you or your administrator a centralized dashboard with a backup status summary of all the computers in your business. And then if there's ever a data loss problem, each employee can access their own backup files. You can be notified of any issues, and your office can be up and running again with no headaches or time lost. And it's safe. Your files are encrypted before they leave your computer. They're transmitted using SSL, the same protocol used by financial institutions, and they're at off-site sophisticated data centers. Ernie, that's kind of an important thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. if you live in a hurricane or earthquake or any place where you might have to leave your home suddenly, fires, backing up online is really critical. You don't want to learn the hard way.
No, you sure don't. And with an option like Carbonite Pro, which you can try for free for 30 days at carbonitepro.com, I don't see why you wouldn't give it a try and make sure that all your important business data is backed up safely, securely, and in a remote location. So thanks, Carbonite, for sponsoring Twill. And right now, I think I want to go ahead and talk about, Colette, a story that you sent in a couple of weeks ago when we were much buzzing about Buzz. And that is something that bears highlighting for anyone who wants to escape Google's clutches once and for all. And this was over on Gizmodo. Called How to Escape Google's Clutches Once and for All. So they've got some step-by-step instructions here on yanking yourself out of the Google infrastructure if that's what you would like to do. Colette, you sent this in. Is this something that you're contemplating or just think that it's a good idea for people to know?
Well, I'm not seriously thinking of leaving their clutches quite yet. I'm always kind of on guard now with Facebook and a little more now with Google. And so I find articles like this really interesting, partly because if you look, I mean, it's a really long article.
But it has screenshots and it has how to, and it's like step by step. And it's the kind of thing I think people should know exists. And, you know, it's got some really good tips that I'm not, you know, going to spend hours geeking out on the settings page, you know, every week. I mean, it's something I want to do once every 6 months, if that. So, you know, I found it to be a really kind of helpful, a little bit tongue-in-cheek article to just think about, you know, if you're getting to that point, here's some ways to either escape partially or escape 100%. It also shows you how to get your email out and everything. So if you've been with Google for a long time and you want to make sure you can still have that history of content that you've written about or, you know, emails you've received and whatnot, it's all there.
Well, we brought this up in the context of buzz and people not being real happy with the way that that was rolled out and the way that their privacy expectations were perhaps thwarted in the course of that rollout. But another way of looking at it is, even though this is a long article and there are several steps to go through, Google does make it pretty easy, relatively speaking, to export your data and use it in other locations. Ernie, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I like Google. I use it a lot. I was very interested in this article. I learned a few things, even though I'm not planning on bailing from Google. I see that they recommend using Zoho Docs as kind of a front end to Google Docs, and that way you get offline editing and all kinds of other cool things. I think the main takeaway is you should be prepared to leave. It kind of reminds me of that line in the movie Heat, which I really liked, the Michael Mann movie where Robert De Niro and Al Pacino play sort of the cat and mouse. One's the cop and the other one's the crook. And Al Pacino's giving advice to the younger criminal guy, I think played by Val Kilmer. And he says, you know, he says, one thing I've learned, he says, you always got to be ready to walk out the door in 30 seconds if you spot the heat around the corner. And I think that's kind of the way it works. You need to be ready to take your data. You know, if you need to take your data, you need to be able to get it out quickly if you want to.
Yeah.
Right. And that actually kind of relates to another thing I tagged for our discussion points. You know that when something hits The Economist, it certainly has bubbled up to some sort of tipping point of popular exposure and importance. And there's an article in there called The Data Deluge: Business, Governments, and Society Are Only Starting to Tap Its Vast Potential. And it goes on to sort of talk about all the data that is available about our everyday lives and how it's being harnessed and how you yourself can sift it and be able to manage it. And then, of course, the dark sides of it, how it can be used against you and various big brother-ish kind of steps that can be taken that you might not expect. But then they go on and they give some, let's see, some guidelines or some suggestions or a prescription for dealing with the drawbacks of the data deluge. And they say that the best way to deal with it is paradoxically to make more data available in the right way by requiring greater transparency in several areas. First, users should be given greater access and control to the information held about them, including whom it is shared with. Google allows users to see what information it holds about them and lets them delete their search histories or modify the targeting of advertising, for example. Second, organizations should be required to disclose details of security breaches. That's actually the law in several places that I can think of. And then finally, third, organizations should be subject to an annual security audit, and I think this is a great idea, with the resulting grade made public, though details of any problems exposed would not be. Did you guys take a look at this, and do you have any thoughts about the data deluge, Colette?
Yes. Well, first of all, I just have to say I love The Economist because they have this ability to be a little bit snarky every once in a while, and they get away with it in a sort of businessy publication. So as a reader, I do love them. I know I never get to get through a whole issue because it's just so, there's so much stuff. But yeah, so I love the idea of a grade. Getting mm-hmm. it audited and having a grade. It reminds me of the restaurants in various cities. When I lived in Los Angeles a number of years ago, they passed a law locally that every restaurant got a grade A to F and had to post it at the door to the restaurant. And right. So when you walked in, you would see what their score was in their most recent visit from the health department. And, you know, there was a lot of controversy because some of it was about sort of certain types of food is prepared in ways that might not seem right to the health department, but that's just the way it's done. And there were some ethnic issues and stuff. But overall, it was awesome because you could, you know, decide as a consumer, like, am I comfortable going into this dive, which I think is awesome, but got a C or an A or a B or whatever. So if we could do that with businesses, both online and offline. I mean, I think offline businesses, you know, the few that remain maybe, you know, should be, you know, viewed this way too. And it would be interesting from a consumer standpoint. Now, you could argue that if the rules are set up and the audits happen, you know, the companies can game how they, you know, anytime you set up new rules, like any kind of legislation or whatever, there's ways to game it. So there's loopholes or whatever. So, you know, there some of that might happen, but I think it would be interesting to see if the public actually changes what they do and what services they use based on privacy concerns. So I think that would be very interesting.
Rar in the chat room says, he or she only eats at restaurants that get a grade D or F. And I remember when I worked in downtown Los Angeles, it's a great analogy, Colette, because it does sort of hold true to our data as well, that, you know, if we were going to go venture into some lesser known and lesser graded restaurant, it was kind of a question of, okay, you know, are your antibiotic prescriptions up to date? You ready to go take that risk? And yeah, I think if businesses were graded that way, people could make similar judgment calls. Ernie, any thoughts?
Well, let me say, I second what Colette said about The Economist. I love The Economist. I subscribe to it. It's one of the few print publications I get, and I always feel guilty if I don't get through it. But when this issue came, which was a technology special, I plunged into it, and I found it fascinating. And there were all kinds of interesting things that I learned in there. And there was one quote in there that I love from Hal Varian, who's the chief economist for Google, who said that data are widely available. What's scarce is the ability to extract wisdom from them. And, you know, there's another quote where they talk, this is sort of an interesting info processing factoid, that the genome sequencing was completed in the year 2003 and it took 10 years. If it were done today, it would take a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Amazing.
I have two follow-up things that popped into my head on this issue. So I was listening to a podcast in the car recently, and it's in the feed for the Center for Internet and Society, and I was going to look it up. But that feed has Hearsay Culture podcast, which is hosted by David Levine, and it's a radio show that he converts into a podcast. But then every fourth or fifth episode in that feed is actually a conference topic or something that the center recorded separately. So it's one of the very recent things, and it has to do with money and privacy. And it's a panel discussion, including Lauren Gelman, who used to be the executive director of the center. Now she has her own private practice. The head of legal at LinkedIn, and then a couple money related companies whose names escape me. Actually, no, one of them was called, it's not money, it was a website, Jabber, I don't know. Anyways, you'll find it if you look at the series of most recent posts on that podcast. And it was very interesting because the first question that Ryan Kahlo asked, and he was the host moderator of the panel, was to all of these companies that rely on
you know, user data and information to do some of what they offer. You know, do you think you can compete with other people in your space based on your privacy standards and policies and commitments? Is that a point of competition among you and your competitors? And, you know, most of the panel, I think, said, yeah, kind of, but not, it's not really where we're putting our eggs, because they don't, I think the consumers generally don't focus on this as much as we who geek out about it every day would. So, but I think it's interesting. And I think if, you know, if a letter grade were assigned to each site or each company, it would make it in a format that competition on that issue could be a little more concrete. So, number one, I recommend listening to that podcast. It was very interesting. Ryan raised 4 or 5 broad questions throughout the hour and 15 minutes or so, and super interesting discussion. But I do think this issue of making privacy issues a point of competition is going to grow. That's my sense. I mean, it's going to become more and more important as everything moves into the cloud, if it hasn't gotten there yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just privacy, but a subspecies of privacy, how we're using and storing your data and what kind of control you have over that, I think, is the other side of the same coin. In fact, J.P. Rangaswamy, do you guys ever read Confused of Calcutta, his blog? And have you ever encountered JP? He's this really smart guy who's been around for a long time. And he has a great post on sharing and privacy and just sort of along the lines of what we're talking about here. I put it in the show notes. It's called Musing About Sharing and Privacy. And folks should really go and read the post. It talks about the Please Rob Me site that we mentioned here on the show before, and sort of how sharing and privacy are two sides of the same coin. But we talk a lot about privacy, we pay a lot of attention to privacy, but not enough attention to the sharing component and how it works and what sort of fine-grained controls you want to have over that. I throw that out just because it's relevant to what we're talking about. Encourage people to check it out. Did you guys read it, and do you have any thoughts, Ernie?
Well, I just checked it out now, and I like this blog. I'm definitely going to. This is going into my Google Reader. He's obviously. I like his first observation, which is an important observation. He said that sharing is an inherently vulnerable act. And it's funny because I used to get this question a lot when I first started blogging, when people weren't doing it as much. And the question usually came from a lawyer friend, you know, at a firm or somewhere, somebody who I didn't really deal with that much anymore, you know, cross paths with only occasionally. And they would take me aside and say, how can you put all that stuff out there on your blog? Like, aren't you afraid that people are going to use that against you? And what was funny is I had spent a lot of time thinking about that, and I decided what I wanted to share and what I didn't. And I don't share certain things, but I don't say what I don't share, so it doesn't get to be a big deal. But yeah, it is vulnerable, but I think vulnerable is what makes you human, and it's what draws people in. And I think that that's something that for lawyers is very difficult, because you know nothing in law school or in the practice of law urges you, tells you anything about being vulnerable. It's all the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, keep your mouth shut, act like you know what you're doing at all times. And yet it's weird because, you know, you were born a human and then you become a lawyer later. So all the basic primal instincts are predominant. And when you are vulnerable to a judge, and I saw this when I clerked for the judge that I worked for 2 years, when lawyers would come in and were in a position of total vulnerability and said, look, this is my deal. My kid's sick, or I have a family vacation. Everything lawyerly went out the window. The judge said, that's fine. I'll do what I can to help you. But it's when we have this facade that we think, you know, is going to work, and yet we really need, you know, this you know, help from the other side. If you were just vulnerable, they'd probably give it to you. But as lawyers, we don't know how to do that. That's just like not in our DNA.
Well, it's in some of our DNA. I think
it gets beaten out of us in law school.
Colette, you were going to say?
No, I really agree with what Ernie says about just focusing in on that first point. You know, anytime you share, you know, here online, you know, in a restaurant with a friend, whatever, you know, there is an inherent vulnerability about that. So, yeah. And I think he's right. I mean, we spend our whole life risk mitigation. You know, how do you mitigate that risk? And how do you narrow the opportunity for bad things to happen? And, you know, that's what we do. So it is, yep. It's like forcing us to be more human. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that's what's really wonderful about the way media has expanded and become what's so exciting about everybody's silly YouTube video or MySpace blurb or whatever is that you, or your tweets, you know, it brings this human side to people. Like I've friends with some people on Facebook that I think of mostly as professional, and occasionally they say something really sweet to their loved one on Facebook. And I feel a little bit like, oh, that's a little bit weird. I don't know if I should know that part of that person. But at the same time, it's like, wow, you know, that's really, you're really human. You know, yeah, of course you have these feelings, you know, or you would say these things. So yeah. I don't know.
We've been trying to get Evan on the show. I hope he can join us. He had a conference call that came up right at the beginning of the show, but he was going to try and jump in with us because I definitely wanted to call out a couple of things in his Facebook status to talk about on the show. And one of them goes right along with what you're saying, Colette. On March 1st at 8:18 p.m., Evan posted, "So happy that Jake picked Vienna." Which just made me laugh so hard. And, you know, again, it's just one of those personal things. The that, you know, says a lot about Evan, just that he has this amazing sense of humor. And also that he's a little bit twisted at the same time. And yet, you know, of course we want to know that about him. The other thing that is in his status here, I want to go ahead and make our tip of the week. And that is that you should never, when you're obnoxiously loudly talking in public on your cell phone and might be in the vicinity of anyone like Evan Brown or his ilk, you should never mention your email address. Because here's what Evan put in a rather lengthy status message here, Wednesday of this week. From Evan: "Sitting at Borders, using my laptop. Woman over there, obnoxiously on her cell phone, told person on the other line her email address. Of course, I Googled it. Now I could totally creep her out. I know her kids' names, where they go to school, her home address, her hobbies, spouse's names, and place of employment, and et cetera." Oh, let's see. It even goes on. "And know the names of all her Facebook friends. Moral of the story, STFU, I won't spell that out. You all know what that means. When you're on your cell phone in public." So thank you, Evan, in absentia, for our tip of the week. And thank you, too, again, for making me laugh over that one. Did you guys realize that you could find out so much from simply Googling someone's email address?
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean... I'm now going to Google all my email addresses, although most of them are public. I mean, I haven't been very good at hiding them. But yeah, interesting. He announced it, though. That's pretty funny.
Yes. I Googled Evan's just for fun. And fortunately, and not surprisingly, he's very circumspect with the kind of information that's associated with his email address. Now, what else could he have done with it? Some of the commenters there on his Facebook page had some great ideas that once you know someone's email address, and if you have not very nice intentions toward them, you could, for example, register her as one hot cougar on www.affair-hotel.com. Or, yeah, you know, you could definitely get people on some interesting mailing lists. Ernie, what do you think we'd find if we Googled your email address? Speaking of sharing.
Well, I just did, and apparently I was involved with something called Between Lawyers a long time ago. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, I still get email about people wanting to advertise on a site where
Ernie and I blogged, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago now. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Crazy, crazy. All right, so that was our tip of the week. Our resource of the week is also rather tongue-in-cheek, but rather not at the same time. There is a new iPhone app available called Tiger Text, and it is... its purpose is to basically make your text messages self-destruct after a matter of time and not come back to haunt you with their longevity. So I thought this was interesting for our show for a couple of reasons. Number one, there are certainly plenty of non-extramarital affair reasons why you might want your text messages to be less lengthy in duration and less prone to discovery. And also, I thought another legal twist on this is that the thing is called Tiger Text and is clearly meaning to invoke Tiger and his whole debacle. So what do you guys think about both those aspects, Colette?
The invoking Tiger and the existence of it.
Yeah, just, you know, I mean, I could definitely see there being this being useful and popular.
Yes.
And not just for people who are trying to cheat on their spouse.
Right. I think there is something. I mean, I don't know how much people know, but, you know, cell phone companies have tons of information that they hold, you know, not only our texts, but also geolocation information and whatnot. So, you know, if there's a way to kind of circumvent that, if you want to have more privacy and it only is as good as the company that's hosting it. So if you're circumventing the text service by using this and that company is deleting the stuff from their logs, then, you know, you're avoiding some issues of data retention that can come to haunt people or just stuff that people don't want to have saved and don't feel a need is it should be saved. I'm intrigued by their using Tiger's name only from the right of publicity and trademark issues point of view, because obviously
the Time magazine article that they linked to says that the developer said that the name was in place before the Tiger Woods texting scandal.
Ah, well, good.
Yeah, that's well, good they're going to have some fun trying to prove that one up.
Yeah, that's a good fact. In place internally, had they already applied for a trademark or saved, gotten a domain? I don't know. The facts will bear out, as you say.
Right. But so, you know, it's a product that somebody described as paying $250 a month for stupidity insurance. So obviously, the developer understands the importance of being smart about, you know, managing information. So of course, he's going to claim he developed it before Tiger. But it's just that coincidence just seems too bizarre.
Yeah,
it does. So anyway, I thought it deserved being called out as our resource of the week for anyone who is interested in having a utility. I would analogize it, although I don't know what sort of security steps they actually do undertake or what level of stupidity insurance you're getting. But I think of it as something like hush mail. You know, if you need to have some confidentiality in your communications, this would be a good tool to have in your arsenal. And who knows if they'll get sued by Tiger or not, but that was kind of an interesting choice of name. One lawsuit that folks were wondering if it would happen or when it would happen has happened, and that is that Apple has gone ahead and sued HTC over the Nexus One phone and the multi-touch technology involved there. There had been some sort of talk, gossip, rumor, innuendo that those lawsuits a lawsuit like that wouldn't be forthcoming, that there might be some sort of tacit agreement between Apple and Google because Apple, I read this somewhere, I don't even remember where now, Apple was a bit reluctant to test the strength of its patent, but apparently that reluctance, if it existed, doesn't exist anymore because
the lawsuit has been filed, and we're going to now see how much of a broad patent reach Apple is going to have in its multi-touch tech. Ernie, you're a big Apple user. Were you surprised and or disappointed to see this get filed?
I'm not surprised by any litigation anymore. So no, this didn't surprise me. I don't know all the intricacies of it. So I really, I'm not a patent lawyer, and I couldn't, I'd have to delve into all of the paperwork and then I'd fall asleep and, I would never be recovered. I mean, I would be interested to see what somebody like, a patent lawyer like, Eric, would say about this because it seems to me that the patent system is broken. Everybody acknowledges that. And it's to the point where companies who don't even want necessarily to enforce a patent will go get one just so that in case somebody else does, they have that as a defense. So it's really like the state of nature that Hobbes described in the Leviathan. You have to assume the other guy's got a gun, so you need to get one too. And that's really where we are with the patent system. And it's really sad, but... I don't really know. I don't know how to reform it. It's a big, complicated mess, and I don't practice patent law, so I'm the worst person to speak to it.
Yeah, there's a good sort of op-ed piece by Farhad Manjoo in Slate, basically using this as an excuse to indict software patents in general and point out the shortcomings of them. Go ahead.
Isn't there a case at the Supreme Court right now waiting to be decided or maybe waiting to be briefed? I can't remember. On software patents. Is that the Bilski case?
There is indeed, yes.
So this could all change.
Yep. It could. So
I'd also heard there was a good article on TechCrunch that laid out each of the patents and like when they issued. I can't find it right away, but some of them issued like a week before the complaint was filed. So they were like hot off the presses. So it's interesting.
Sorry, guys. I just had a little bit of a technical glitch there, but I am back. All of a sudden, I couldn't hear you. I could see you talking and had no idea what you were saying. So... rather than have you catch me too much up here, just wanted to flag that and let people know that that lawsuit had been filed and sort of the other shoe dropped there. We'll have to follow along and see what happens because obviously this has a huge impact on other touchscreen devices, not just the HTC Nexus phone, but this is, sort of... A way that things are being done here. And my mic is cutting out again. One second.
Sounds good.
Sorry
to
have this happen.
Yeah, you sound fine to us.
There we go.
We'll just splice this part together.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. Just give me a minute here.
I'll go back to the Economist.
Seems to be failing. Thanks. You guys take it for a second, and I'll be back.
Sure.
Okay. Go back to the Economist discussion we had earlier, Colette. Do you know Brian Garner of Black's Law Dictionary fame, and he's written the book on legal writing now with Scalia.
Right. Yeah.
I went to a seminar that he gave about writing, and he's an amazing speaker. If you ever have a chance to see him speak, you should. But he recommended that if people want to improve their legal writing, they should do two things. They should subscribe to two publications, The Economist and The New Yorker. And I think he's absolutely right. The writing in those two magazines is head and shoulders above anything else. It's very... thoughtful, the sentence construction, the paragraph, the development of ideas is just amazing. And I really think that lawyers could tremendously improve their writing if they would read The Economist.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I taught legal writing at Golden Gate University for a few semesters a few years ago. And, you're those kind of courses are very like, how do you IRAC, you know, how do you
paragraph
together that's very lawyerly. But right. But yeah, when you get that done and you're cool with that kind of stuff, it's great. I think, yeah, from writing and telling a story and you know, explaining fairly complex, I mean, The Economist is explaining very complicated stuff most of the time. I mean, stuff that I don't typically understand when I think about economics and business and whatever. So it is kind of the same thing that lawyers do in briefs, but in a you know, different, you know, subject matter. But I agree with you. Right. I think both of those are excellent from that standpoint. It's interesting that he's recommending those.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked. I was thinking, wow, I got that in the bag because those are the only two that I subscribe
I know.
To.
Those are my two. I have three publications that I subscribe to, but those are two of the three.
Hey guys, I fixed my glitchy recorder. Sorry about that. So Colette, you sent in something for us that when I tweeted out, I got a lot of interest in. It's probably not as interesting as it sounds. It's one of these cases at the Supreme Court where the underlying substance of the case, which has to do with whether freelance writers have to register copyrights in order to be able to enforce them, is probably more interesting than the actual outcome, which turned on a jurisdictional basis. Is there anything that folks can take away from this case that is anything that changes the playing field in copyright law?
Yeah, I mean, it changes a little bit of the playing field in copyright law for sure. But my takeaway is we need our members of Congress and people drafting legislation to be more clear when they want to make something a jurisdictional requirement for a federal court. And basically the case is, it's this lengthy case that's kind of, you could say, has been going on since Tassini, I think, because Tassini was a Supreme Court case a number of years ago, that the result of which created a bunch more lawsuits. And those lawsuits were combined into a multi-district litigation that this settlement was supposed to resolve. And when the case was resolved by the district court on appeal, by some of the people who objected to the settlement on appeal, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals decided, hey, wait a second, federal courts don't have jurisdiction here because the settlement class included unregistered works. Now, to just unpack that quickly, the copyright question, the copyright statute requires that if you want to sue, you have to register your work first if you're a United States work. So there are some exceptions, but we're talking about United States works. So you have to sue, and you have to register in order to sue. And because the settlement class included both unregistered and registered works, the court felt like they didn't have sufficient rights. So sufficient jurisdiction to actually, you know, rule on the appeal and basically cut all the case completely apart. And that issue then was appealed to the Supreme Court about whether this section of the Copyright Act actually affects jurisdiction of the court or if it's just a precondition of the plaintiff's obligation before filing suit. So that's the issue came down to in the Supreme Court was, do the courts have jurisdiction or does this section only provide what's called a precondition? And it really, if you read it, and this is the first case you've ever read from the Supreme Court, you'd be like, oh my God, this is like killing me because it's kind of boring and it's kind of like so technical. And it really is like splitting hairs, you know, is this a precondition or not? And so that aside, my takeaway is Congress should just know that if you're making a jurisdictional claim in a statute, put it in the section on jurisdiction. Don't scatter it throughout the statute. And if our legislatures could do that, we could have avoided a lot of this pain over the last year of this case on the appeal and what the district court the Second Circuit did. So that's my takeaway.
Great. Evan just joined us. Hi, Evan Brown. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you. I can't believe that you guys are still talking. I began to lose all hope there. I was on a conference call that started at 1 p.m. Central and then kept watching the clock tick away. So glad I can join you even if it's at the 11th hour here.
Yes, we're so glad you could too. And of course, we will always talk and talk and talk until we can get you on the show.
I'm flattered.
Hey, we were just talking about this freelance writer's copyright registration case. Did you have any thoughts on that? You had emailed us that you thought it was a big deal.
Yeah, I changed my mind after I actually read the case. It turns out I was expecting the answer to the question of whether or not a copyright plaintiff actually has to have the registration certificate in hand before he or she, goes into court. And the question before the court was actually a little bit different than that. And so, of course, Justice Thomas gave us the answer to the question that was actually before the court. And it turns out, and I know I just, joined in. So I know that you were talking about it, Colette, and talking about how it deals with some pretty nuanced subject matter jurisdiction issues. And that really is what it seems to be here. Something that's pretty, it's almost a wonky kind of opinion, whether or not a federal court has subject matter jurisdiction over a copyright claim if there are unregistered works at issue. In the end, I don't think it changes the analysis it doesn't change the effect of whether or not a case should get thrown out if there is an unregistered work at issue. It's just that now we have a little bit more precision as to what the basis for throwing that out is, a lack of having met certain formalities versus a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. So in the end, the results are still the same, but on an academic, more ethereal, abstract level, we know the basis for that.
Thanks so much. Hey, Colette, I know you need to run, so we'll go ahead and say goodbye, and thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Yeah, it was great.
Thank you.
Enjoy the show.
Folks can find Colette at vogelaw.com and at vogelaw on Twitter. So we'll see you next week when you're at South by Southwest.
Yeah, and I hope to see some people at South by. So please come find me or, tweet to me and at vogelaw, and we'll meet up there. I'm really looking forward to being able to go this year.
Are you on
it's
a panel?
Be awesome.
I'm not. I just get to go and, network and meet people and learn what's going on. I had to miss last year, so I'm so excited. And just to be clear, I'm there for the interactive, which is the 11th to the 16th. I'm unfortunately not staying for the music part, but the interactive part I think is where all the fun happens anyways, so.
Oh, yeah. No, I've been dying to go for years and just haven't been able to make it work. So we're looking forward to getting your on-the-ground report from the conference. So we'll talk to you then.
Okay. Bye.
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 See ya.
So I want to go ahead and take another break here and give folks a recommendation for an Audible book. This one comes courtesy of my dad's bookshelf. It is called, let me pull it up here so I get the right title. It is called How to Build a Dinosaur. Extinction Doesn't Have to Be Forever. It's by Jack Horner and James Gorman. It's narrated by Pat Lawler. And it is by a paleontologist. One of these folks is a paleontologist that advised the Jurassic Park movies. And this guy's concept is that you could actually manipulate chicken DNA and come up with something close to a dinosaur. So it sounds a little creepy and a little fun. And the unabridged version is on Audible, and it can be yours for free at audiblepodcast.com/twill. Sign up for the Audible Gold Listening Program, which is $14.95 a month. It gets you a credit for one book each month. And those don't expire. They just keep racking up. You can use them whenever you'd like. And this one looks like it's going to be a really fun read. So check out How to Make Dinosaurs and audible.com. You can also follow Audible at audible_com on Twitter. And we really, really thank them for being a longtime sponsor of Twill.
Wonder what a genetically modified chicken that takes the form of a dinosaur would taste like.
Chicken.
It reminds me. There's some new legislation or some new regulation out there in California that just passed that restricts the import into California of non-native frogs and turtles for purposes of human consumption. So I just thought, wow, that really does give a boon to the market for local turtles and frogs. You know, so
yes,
whatever.
Absolutely, it's protectionism for our local frog farmers.
But not so much protectionism for the local frogs, evidently.
No, I guess we'll have to take my son's frogs off the menu then, since they're non-native species. He'll be happy about that. Yeah. So, Evan, we were talking about you behind your back and pulling out things from your Facebook status that we thought were funny. So, sorry if we thwarted your privacy expectations by doing that.
Oh, well, yeah, I suppose that at some point I waived that reasonable expectation by sharing it with everybody. But yeah, that was an interesting situation when I was sitting there in Borders the other day. Is that the one you were talking about?
Yes. We actually made that our tip of the week, not to give your email address out when you're obnoxiously talking on your cell phone in public.
And, you know, just to be clear about it, I wasn't doing it to be voyeuristic or to be creepy or whatever. It was because I was so darn irritated with that woman. You know, we were sitting there around, you know, working on her laptops. Everybody was quiet, enjoying coffee, looking at magazines, and she just takes the call. And of course, it was an obnoxious ringtone. And she just, you know, she said, "Oh, well, I've got to be quiet because I'm at Borders. That's why I'm not talking so loudly." And people were just kind of looking around, chuckling. So it was just because I was so irritated that I wanted to, you know, change that dynamic and just know what I, or, you know, come to know what I ended up knowing. So it was really funny.
I love that someone wanted to register her under various lascivious usernames using her email address.
Yeah, well, trust me, she wouldn't have gotten much traction there.
Oh, too bad. All right, so still on our list of actual substantive things to discuss are a couple of things out of Australia. Apparently the Aussies are concerned about the dark side of Facebook, and have actually been writing, their officials have been writing to Mark Zuckerberg, about, things that have gone on the site. I guess they had sort of a bunch of things happen all at once. There were some pornographic images that showed up on, a tribute page to a schoolboy who had been killed. There were online vigilantes calling for the death penalty for the accused murderer of that same person, and all sorts of things that were going on in sort of the cybercrime and bullying vein that... that were frightening and prompted someone to write to Facebook, who was an official from the Australian government, and try and get some attention to these issues. Do you guys get the feeling that Facebook is becoming lawless, or that any of this is new, or was this just kind of a confluence of events that made a public official get their dander up? What do you think, Ernie?
Well, I think this is, you know, kind of a strain of the same ilk as the Google Italian case that we talked about last week. And it kind of reminds me, what I see here is that, you know, you're having this tension between governments, which traditionally could decree and expect that, you know, people would obey their decrees. And now you have these large companies that transcend the sovereignty of particular nation state borders that, you know, bring together a bunch of people in new ways. And it kind of reminds me of John Perry Barlow's Declaration of Independence in Cyberspace, where he begins by saying, you know, governments of the industrial world, you know, I come from cyberspace, the home of the mind, and we ask you of the past to leave us alone. You're not welcome. You have no sovereignty where we gather. And, you know, it's kind of like online gambling, you know, all of these things where, you know, people just persist in behaving in a certain way because that's the way they want to behave. And we can't really figure out, when I say we, I'm shifting gears, not me, but governments can't really figure out how to control, regulate, you know, this sort of behavior. And I think it's kind of like watching the twitching of a dying animal. You know, it's kind of harsh, but that's really the way I see it, because I just don't see that these efforts are going to do. I mean, of course, Facebook and Google will make some, you know, efforts to try to comply and to be reasonable, to explain themselves. But at some point, you know, when the people who are attempting to regulate them really can't regulate them effectively, number one, and number two, don't really understand what they're doing, or, you know, and can't really understand what they're doing because of all the reasons that, you know, Barlow, you know, predicted or discussed in his declaration, you've got a really weird situation.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
I don't know how it's going to be.
Evan, do you think that there needs to be a more streamlined process for getting at the anonymity of people who are engaged in wrongdoing on sites like Facebook?
Perhaps technologically it could be a bit more streamlined, you know, because now it's at least a two-step process, you know, figuring out the IP address and then figuring out who that IP address belongs to. So I think that there are ways that could make that process more streamlined without sacrificing the legal protections that are there to protect the First Amendment right to speak anonymously. You know, Ernie, you characterized it very well by saying it's a weird situation, and it is, and it certainly is an evolutionary state that's coming to fruition now, almost 20 years after John Perry Barlow, you know, talked about that Declaration of Independence, you know, that addresses in very broad and sweeping terms the role of governance, or the mode, the form of governance in cyberspace. And I just got through reading an article by Brian Holland down at Texas Wesleyan. He's a professor there, and I met him at a conference last week. So I've been reading some of his work, and he wrote a great article. If you just search on SSRN for Brian Holland, about Section 230 that was published, I think, in the Kansas Law Review a year or so ago, which is a great exposition of Section 230 and the role that it plays, and the ability for Section 230 to provide some space where there is a healthy environment for the expansion of this internet exceptionalism that we often talk about in negative terms, thinking that there ought to be new rules and new ways of looking at the internet just because it's the internet. But it talks about internet exceptionalism in kind of a different way than what we brought it up in conversations here before. And what it focuses on is the changing of norms and the development of communities and the development of rules to govern those communities in the online space that are different and are perhaps operate at a different layer or a different level in the hierarchy as what ordinary legal governance operates. And so that seems most intuitively to be the proper way of thinking about managing problems like this, when freaky stuff and scary stuff and very harmful and disturbing things begin to happen in this online space. Facebook is becoming much more now like the community at large, the world at large, than it is just a particular online destination and an online space. So the role of the law and the role of legal mechanisms to provide the appropriate governance in a space like that is, I think, deficient, and it's going to cause and necessitate certain revisiting of these norms and the overall structures. So that was kind of a circuitous way of getting back to this whole question of anonymity. That is one way that these technological streamlining of figuring out who is whom is important, and I think it should be there just because it can be easier. But there should not be a dissolution or any kind of diminution of these both the legal protections for anonymity and also the norms that would develop around the importance of an important concept like free speech.
Yeah, there's a cyberspace law professor cited in this Sydney Morning Herald article talking about these issues in Australia, who has a great quote. His name's David Vail, I think is how you would pronounce it. He says, if you say you need one trained lawyer for every 50 users, that's most of the social networking models out the window. So, yeah, there's got to be an appropriate balance, I think, is his point, between how the law steps in and regulates these things and how the sites themselves and the users and the community manage to accomplish that.
It really is amazing to think about how few instances of bad stuff there are in proportion to the number of people that there are online. I don't know of any data behind this, but just based on real experience, yes, cyberbullying is a problem. Yes, online defamation is a problem. Yes, horrendous things like what's described in this article, posting pornography in an inappropriate form and all that stuff, is, you know, those things happen. But I just have to believe that the number of instances of things like that that happen in comparison to the number of participants in the online space, that term being most broadly defined as just everybody online, compare that. That has to be such a smaller number of instances compared to the crimes that are committed in the world at large. And that seems to be a testament to the evolution of these norms and the way that they apply and the general sensibilities that people bring to their online experience and their online interactions with one another.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that, Ernie, before we leave this one?
Big amen.
Amen, brother. Okay, so we've talked a lot about managing risk on the show and doing your sharing and work in a risk-sensible way. And one of our sponsors is a great tool for that, and it is GoToMyPC. GoToMyPC, if you haven't tried it yet, it's not complicated at all to give it a try. It's really easy. You get the computer you want to access remotely. So if you have a work computer or a home computer that you need to get access to and you're traveling or away from that spot, you go to gotomypc.com/twill. You click download. And the setup is completely automatic. It takes just 2 minutes. Then when you want to access that computer, you open up a web browser wherever you may be. Go to gotomypc.com. You enter your secure password. You click connect and you're in. And then you can use any program, work on any file, check email, access network resources, and that's it. It's that easy. You can try it free for 30 days. If you go to gotomypc.com/twill, and again, it is secure, it is simple to use, and you can get all your work done wherever you may be. So check it out, gotomypc.com/twill. So Evan, let's see, also from Australia, since we were on the Australia beat there, we talked a few weeks ago about the iiNet case, and that was a case you were mentioning, Section 230, where the entertainment industry in Australia, their equivalent of the MPAA, which represents 34 Australian film companies, was attempting to hold an ISP liable for infringing activities of its users that were going on there. It got slapped down. The AFACT is the film industry group that lost its original case. But they have now said that they're going to appeal. The lawsuit's going forward. Do you think that there's chance? How do you ballpark this one, Evan?
I think our knee-jerk reaction, given the fact that we tend to prefer openness and pressure taken off the intermediary, is, you know, for us to want to ballpark this as hoping that this appeal is unsuccessful. And to say that would go in line with what I was talking about earlier of these, it seems like I get on a theme and then I just can't see the world in any other way. But, you know, what I'm talking about here of the application of norms external to the law or in supplement to the law. So the troublesome aspect of the Australian decision and what we see from reading this article here is this notion of authorization, of whether or not the ISP was to authorize this infringement to take place through its servers. And, you know, this is such it's a theme that we talk about time and time again, the difficulty that would be put on an intermediary being required to police every bit of data that goes through its system. It's technologically difficult. It's difficult in terms of the the human resources that would be involved. You know, going back to the taking the statement from the previous story we were just discussing, it's really going to take 50 lawyers for every user of a system. That shuts down the business model for most. Well, they were talking about social media there, but for any kind of intermediary, whether they just be a technological conduit, so to speak. I guess the flip side of that would be that having 50 or one lawyer for every 50 users of an interactive service would help us with this glut of newly minted lawyers that, you know, would have these nice new JDs. That
would and be no one jobs. Solution.
Right. It'd kind of like be the new deal for a recessed legal economy. But anyway, to ballpark this, I hope that the appeal is unsuccessful because I like making it easier for ISPs and the intermediaries to do their job of permitting information to be distributed free as possible of unreasonable restraints and restrictions.
Yeah. Ernie, do you have any thoughts on round two of this iiNet case?
Well, I wish I knew more about procedurally how things work in Australia. I mean, if I analogize it to our system, it sounds like there was a trial and the trial court made a ruling. And of course, whenever people don't like the trial court ruling, they routinely appeal. And I guess that's what's happening there. But I'm with Evan. You know, I hope that the appeal is unsuccessful. I think that ISPs are a necessary ingredient in our wonderful distribution system that, you know, is free to most people and, you know, to distribute their content. And I think that the way to keep that content flowing freely is to make sure that those who are flowing it aren't subject to needless haranguing and silly litigation.
Well, on that note, I want to go out on a story about ISO Hunt. I can't remember if we've talked about ISO Hunt on the show before, but it is a torrent search engine that was sued and under the United States Supreme Court's Grokster ruling was found to have induced infringement in a variety of ways and thus was shut down. We have a blurb from TechDirt here saying that it appears the site's owner, Gary Fung, is interested in seeing if he can try and thread the needle of setting up a site that still works as a torrent search engine but avoids any of the things that were flagged for inducing infringement, which is sort of a case study in the hoops that you have to jump through to put a service out there and yet try to avoid liability under this Grokster ruling. Evan, what do you think about this? Is it possible for them to do this if they simply tread lightly enough and don't go out there and tout their site as a place where you can find infringing material?
It seems like that would go a long way. The judge's opinion in the ISO Hunt case was very detailed. It was a long opinion, and it went into a significant amount of discussion as to those things which led to a finding of this notion of inducement liability, the marketing of the product and setting up the site in such a way that it was really encouraging its users to infringe copyright. And among those things were, you know, categorization of content, you know, top 25 movies and you know, content that was presumably protected by copyright just because of its current nature and its desirability and all of that stuff. So I don't think it is an entirely fruitless or futile pursuit to go about setting up a site that's like this. It certainly requires some care in the way that the site is constructed and the directives that are given to the users and the resulting abilities that users have to affect the way that content is organized on the site. So I think it's a noble goal, a noble pursuit. We shouldn't be so naive, though, as to think that a site in this space in the ecosystem and the nature of the kinds of users that it has is going to be one that's all of a sudden going to be distributing non-infringing content all of a sudden. It's not that people are all of a sudden going to become interested in, you know, 15th century medieval poetry and sharing that only on these torrent sites, or, you know, old films that are in the public domain, or only U.S. government works. You know, we shouldn't be as ostrich head in the sand as to think that that's what's going to happen. Just as the you know, the provider cannot be ostrich in the sand, blind to what his or her users are doing under this notion of inducement liability. So a good try. They might as well try it. We have some guidance from the court on this. So why not? Go for it. I'm sure that Mr. Fung doesn't have anything better to do.
Well, I'm waiting for the day when sites like this, when you were not so preoccupied by targeting sites that might surface infringing material, and when the lawsuits on this begin to trickle away, and I'm not seeing huge indication that that's happening, and I just don't. Is this battle has been going on for so long since the Napster decision so long ago, and I'm just kind of flabbergasted that we're still bogged down in sort of this target practice at the individual tools, rather than a huge shift in the way we think about finding and using material that is available online and, you know, compensating the rights holders for it. That's mm-hmm. sort of a long-winded way of saying that, well, I have an example in mind. My son is at an age where Pokemon has come into his life. And, you know, Pokemon, I don't even know when the original series came out. I feel like I was a kid when it did. And lo and behold, it's really, really easy, it turns out. You don't need a torrent site. You don't need any sort of, you know, DVD ripping technology. All you need is a search engine and a list of the episodes of the show, and from any number of locations. Yeah, Charizard, someone's in the chat room is saying, you can find, I think there's something like 12 seasons of this show. You can find them all. You can find them all online. It's super easy. It's not, you know, limited to any particular player. It's widely distributed. And I've got to think that the rights holders in that case have seen the light, because they haven't gone on target practice. This stuff is out there and available. And I'm sure they probably wouldn't come out publicly and say, you know, yeah, we're going to go ahead and enable this infringement. And here's why. Because it's giving a whole new life to our franchise. We have all kinds of products and things that are tied in with the show, and if we can get new generations hooked on Charizard and the rest, then all the better for us. And, you know, maybe that's just a limited model, and maybe I'm just speculating, and yeah, they'd much rather that this stuff wasn't available, but it's just too popular and too many people are putting it out there. Who knows? But that does seem like an example of something that is a small shift. I don't know. Ernie, do you see any indication that this war between the content side and the consumption side is going anywhere?
I think you made a good point talking about Pokemon. And there, of course, are some ways we can distinguish it a little bit to maybe explain why the proprietors, we'll just use, for lack of a better term, of Pokemon, might see it a little bit differently. Two things, I imagine. One is they're starting to see that it's a uphill battle, one that can't successfully be won without a lot of effort. And two, there is a certain benefit more readily realized to them in allowing a lot of this just pure content to be out there for sharing, because it supports these other aspects of the business model, the sale of merchandise and goods that are purchased mostly by either kids with their allowance money from their parents or directly by the parents. So it, in that way, we can distinguish it a little bit from other forms of big content like music and movies, because the sale of those things is the be all and end all. Yes, there's a little bit of an ancillary market to some of these things, you know, the action figures from the movie or whatever, but not so much as integrated into what Pokemon does there. So perhaps and hopefully it can be a sign of of some evolution in thinking here, perhaps say it, it's a bit more enlightening to realize what proponents of remix culture and of sharing and openness and expounding upon and making available more works for reuse, realizing the ways that that can enhance the market and not just be a minus sign in a particular column for a sale of an instance of the work.
Hey, speaking of something that is definitely a step in a breakthrough direction, Virgil in the chat room has pointed me toward a link, a translated link from the Swedish, from looks like a government representative from the Justice Department, Department of Foreign Affairs in Sweden, that they are announcing that the EU member states have agreed to work together toward the earliest possible release of the draft agreement in the ACTA negotiations. The agreement reached at today's meeting of EU Trade Policy Committee means that the EU should actively encourage other ACTA partners to back this. And so, I mean, it's not giving us a date, it's not giving us a time, but at least it's giving us some commitment from the EU to go ahead and release the much-discussed ACTA agreement. So,
wouldn't it be funny if when it's finally made public, it's like totally different than what we've been speculating? It has nothing about graduated response. Like, we weren't thinking that. Why would it be so silly?
Yeah. So much for rumors, huh? Right. Well, we'll just have to see. Anyway, I think Ernie's equipment has failed on him. My equipment failed on me earlier. Oh, no, you're back. You're back. Yay.
I'm back.
All right. Well, I just, it's time for us to wrap things up anyway, but I'm glad we have the chance to say goodbye to you, Ernie. Thanks so much for joining us again on Twill 50.
Great to be here as always.
Great. Folks can find Ernie online at ErnieTheAttorney.net, at Ernie Attorney on Twitter. And we'll see you next week. Thanks again for being on the show.
Great. Look forward to it. Take care.
All right. You too. Evan, we're glad you could join us. Late, definitely better than never.
Yes, yeah. I'm certainly glad I could join you too. Thanks for waiting around. And congratulations on making it to episode 50. This is a great podcast and a great show, you know. And I'm really happy to be a part of it. So I appreciate getting invited back.
Thank you so much. And you have been a big part of that. So I really appreciate all your contributions to so many of our shows.
It's the highlight of my week. That's for sure.
It's great fun for me. I really love getting together with our group and the 400 some odd people in the chat room every week. So folks should definitely check out Evan's blog in the meantime between shows. He's at internetcases.com and always has cool stuff there to write about and discuss, and at Internet Cases on Twitter, where hopefully you can find more links to the stuff that Evan's up to and his opinions on what's going on The Bachelor and whatever else might be on his mind.
People do see that stuff, don't they?
No, that was the other thing we were talking about, is how much fun it is to be able to see that stuff. So, thanks so much, and we'll see you next time for 1251. Folks can find me if you have comments or questions or anything at all you want to chat about the show, denise@twit.tv, or hit me up on Twitter. I'm at D Howell. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.
See you later.
Bye.